Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Brex and Lav. And folks, this will likely be the most jam-packed midweek edition of the year. America has a new Ryder Cup captain. It is not Phil Mickelson. It is not Tiger Woods. Heck, it is not even Stuart Sink. The appointment after all these months is Keegan Bradley. Rex, to say that this has been a polarizing choice would be the understatement of the year. Where do you land on the great debate?
This is completely unscripted, and I'm going to hit you with this because I meant to text you last night and I got busy. So you and I were on Golf Today yesterday doing our roundtable, our weekly roundtable. It was with Eamon and Damon, who we adore. And we were on with Golf Digest Shane Ryan. And Shane went first with this answer. And I don't know what your reaction was, but he went scorched earth on the PGA of America. He went scorched earth on the idea that Keegan Bradley should ever be considered for a captaincy, let alone picked as a captain. It was an interesting transition to where I wanted to come in, because I thought I had the hot take when I was workshopping it earlier in the week. You know, and I was thinking to myself, well, do I like this? Do I don't like this? My take was not nearly as his was point blank. It was a bad choice. Mine was, it's a bad choice only by comparison. Because I keep going back to the idea that if you and I are doing this podcast 5 years ago, we are salivating at the idea that it could possibly be some combination of Phil Mickelson, the U.S. captain, as you pointed out, and on the European side, it would be either be Ian Poulter or Sergio Garcia. Neither one are bad choices. It would be magical. They would be barking at each other. The crowds would be crazy. You'd be in New York City. It's Bethpage Black. It's what we live for. That's the kind of content that not just us in the golf media, but I think golf fans everywhere live for. That sort of explosion of content is what it would be. Now transition forward. That clearly didn't happen because of LIV Golf, and Phil Mickelson was not considered for a captain. Either were Ian Poulter or Sergio Garcia. So the backup for the United States was Tiger Woods. And you probably thought to yourself, huh, okay, I like that option. Sure, we can have fun with that. And to land on Keegan Bradley and Luke Donald, and nothing against either one of them, a monsoon of credit to both of them for what they've accomplished in their careers. Keegan Bradley has the credentials. You may not like the pick. You may like him as a pick. Doesn't matter. He has the credentials. He's won a major championship, the one that really matters to the PGA of America, the PGA Championship. He's played in two Ryder Cups. One of them was on the winning side. So he's got everything in his favor.
Both losses. Keegan Bradley lost in 2012, the collapse at Medina, as well as Glen Eagles in 2014.
He had a winning record. At Medina. Yep. He was the only highlight of that. You're correct there. So he has all the credentials. It's just by comparison. Where we were supposed to be, this just falls flat. That's my take.
So Shane Ryan, who you and I both very much enjoy, I think one of the best golf writers in the game, if not one of the best sports writers, period, called it, I believe, the most stupefying decision in the history of the sport. Then you went and basically said, yeah, like, yeah, I don't like it compared to Tiger and Phil. And then I went like the complete opposite end of the spectrum and said that I actually like this move. I said it on Golf Central on Monday night when the decision came out that Keegan Bradley was the captain. I said it again on Tuesday. And if you guys think that I'm, kind of a bandwagon, a fan on this point.
Being the contrarian?
Yes. Here, Rex, are my notes from the 2024 Live from the PGA Championship Wednesday show. And this was following the PGA of America press conference in which they were asked about Tiger Woods and whether he was going to be the captain. And here were the notes that I jotted down, in which I said Keegan Bradley should be considered for the U.S. Ryder Cup captaincy. And my point there, for those who are not following along on YouTube, is that I do believe that you have to try and match the intensity and passion of what's going to be a crowd unlike any we've seen in the Ryder Cup before. And Keegan Bradley, to me, is the most inspired choice in that realm, because what the PGA of America is essentially doing with this modern Ryder Cup is you're creating like a face of the program, a face of the franchise, someone who sets the overarching tone with his personality, someone who faces the media, obviously has to explain some of the decisions he's making, a player who I think now needs to be more deeply connected with the team's players. There's always been this divide. I know Zach Johnson was on sort of the younger spectrum there, but a Steve Stricker, a Davis Love, a Jim Furyk, there was like a 20-year age gap between what was the Ryder Cup leadership and the Ryder Cup players. And so they're trying to bridge that gap as well. And this face of the franchise is essentially you know, creating the best possible environment for the team to thrive in. And in that respect, you know, I think Keegan Bradley makes a lot of sense. He obviously is passionate about the event, but that is not the only attribute that he brings to the table. Every Ryder Cup captain is passionate about the event. Otherwise, they wouldn't assume the position. Their legacies are the ones that are at stake here. You know, they desperately want to win. I think Keegan brings a lot of smarts. He brings a lot of analytics. He brings connections. He brings thoughtfulness. Obviously, it's too early to say whether this will be a successful move or not, but I actually applaud the PGA of America for going to this decision with Keegan Bradley.
And I'm going to, all right, I am going to play the contrarian here a little bit on this front, because I was very much not on Shane's side of this, and I'm clearly not very much on your shot side of it. It was not a great decision in my mind. I'm not sure there was a great decision out there for the PGA of America. I will give you credit that, yes, they're clearly thinking outside the box. They have clearly pivoted from where they were just a decade ago when they created the task force, the idea that you wanted to create this continuity of leadership, where if you were going to become a captain, and Davis Love has explained this to me before, that it's essentially a 10-year commitment where you're going to serve as a vice captain at least one time, probably twice. Then you're going to do your turn as a captain, and then you're going to have to serve as a vice captain again at least once or twice, because what you want to do is pass along all those knowledge, all that knowledge. They were trying to copy what sort of happened organically with the European team over all of those decades. They have clearly gone against that. Keegan Bradley has never been a vice captain, let alone a captain for either a Ryder Cup or a President's Cup team. So that did not matter. They have pivoted away from the idea that you need to be of a certain age, late 40s, somewhere in the 50s, somewhere around in there with this pick. But the idea, the passion, I rolled my eyes at, because you're right. They're all passionate. They have to be. You're not going to take the job if you're not going to be passionate about it. It's going to consume 2 years of your life. I would hope that you're passionate about it. The other one that was brought up in this press conference yesterday, the idea that, oh, he's from New England, he's going to bring something special to the table. Trust me, if Steve Stricker was the captain, if Zach Johnson was the captain, if you were the captain, the New York crowds are going to be behind this team. That's not going to matter at all. And to be fair, I interviewed about a half dozen players here at the Scottish Open, American players yesterday, about this idea. And almost all of them will tell you that, look, they all feel bad for Zach Johnson, because there was nothing Zach could have done in Rome to turn that tide. That entire team just played poorly. So I don't know if Keegan's going to be a good captain or a bad captain. Only time is going to tell. But it's not going to matter if his team doesn't show up and play well. We always read too much into this. That's why it's fun for you and I. And certainly Shane Ryan had a really good time with it, bantering this back and forth, and the idea that it's a terrible pick, it's a great pick, and how about if we just fall somewhere in between? It's really not going to matter if the Americans show up next year at Bethpage and do the same thing they did last year in Rome.
What do you think, Rex, of the PGA of America's decision-making process? The fact that Tiger Woods rejected the invitation sometime after the PGA Championship. He said that his sort of loyalties and his responsibilities were divided between the PGA Tour and PIF deal. He has a lot going on with the TGL, which they're hoping to launch in early 2025. And oh, don't forget, he also is competing a few times a year and desperately wants to win, obviously, one more major championship, but one more PGA Tour event as well, which would make him the winningest PGA Tour player of all time. To me, not even interviewing Keegan Bradley for the job seemed bizarre, unorthodox. It seemed like there was really no plan B. If you read some of these sort of inside the decision type stories that have come out now, on Wednesday morning, there was an hour and a half Zoom call. But once Keegan Bradley's name was mentioned during the first 5 minutes, the meeting was essentially wrapped. What do you make of John Lindert's explanation on Tuesday and how they actually arrived at this?
He called it a slam dunk. John Lindert did. Called this a slam dunk. He was a name that you and I would not have thought of before this announcement. Here's a name that most people in golf, I would say the vast majority of people in golf, would not have come up with. And somehow the PGA of America came to the conclusion that Keegan Bradley is a slam dunk. Now, maybe he is. Again, only time is going to decide that fate. I don't understand this decision-making at all, because the first time that they talk to Keegan Bradley is to offer him the job on the Sunday of Travelers Championship. So essentially 2 weeks ago, I talked to another player that should have been on that shortlist. I'm assuming he would have been on that shortlist. He didn't talk to anybody from the PGA of America. It's baffling to me that you're going to make a decision like this. Would you hire a manager for your beloved Atlanta Braves and never actually interview him? Are you just going to base this on, well, I know he's a nice guy, he's got passion, he's from New England, or I'm sorry, he's from DeKalb County, so we're going to pull him in because he seems like a good fit? You're never going to do that. You're never going to hire anyone for a job, and trust me, this is a job, without interviewing him. This is going to end up backfiring, I fear, for the PGA of America.
That to me is where some of the criticism is warranted, where this felt like a gross overreaction to what happened in Rome, where a lot of people took exception with Zach Johnson's leadership style. They didn't like some of the perceived infighting, some of the sort of Patrick Cantlay, Xander Schauffele, Stefan Schauffele drama about paying for play, like all of that sort of disconnect. I feel like this was sort of a overreaction to that. And listening to the explanation and knowing how it played out so vividly for Netflix documentarians last year, it almost, Rex, it almost, the skeptic in you, the cynic in you could say, it almost felt a little bit scripted. That Zach Johnson, in concert with the PGA Tour and the PGA of America, in that documentary last year for Full Swing, calling and giving the devastating phone call to Keegan Bradley, it was the obviously the most viral moment of that entire season. Now Zach Johnson is the one who's calling Keegan Bradley to deliver the news. I think it's easy to imagine Netflix filming this just that they did a year ago. I'm with you that I do think that this is taking on a ton of risk, just as PGA of America president Ted Bishop did by announcing Tom Watson for the 2014 Ryder Cup. We all know how that one went, and that eventually led to the formation of the U.S. Ryder Cup Task Force. The counter to that, though, is that the Americans will be enormous home favorites, just as they are each and every single time. The crowd itself at Bethpage Black, 40 or 50,000 strong each day, should account for 3 to 4 points, I would think, in the overall spread, in addition to what's probably going to be a world ranking advantage anyway. Keep in mind, the Americans have also won their last two home cups by a spread of 36 to 20. So if you are going to take a risk, this feels like Keegan Bradley could not possibly bungle it so badly, botch it so badly that they surrender that sort of advantage. To me, it feels like a high upside pick that the benefits potentially outweigh any sort of risk. And the benefit of a huge paradigm shift is pretty appealing to the PGA of America.
I can see your opinion swaying dramatically. If we end up on Sunday night with a dramatic U.S. loss, I can see your opinion.
Oh, I mean, they will be inundated. They will be inundated with criticism, not just Keegan Bradley, but PGA of America leadership. Yeah. I mean, Seth Waugh, who's the outgoing PGA of America CEO, obviously John Linder was involved in this decision as well. They will receive a monsoon of criticism, and it will fall all on them for appointing Keegan Bradley without even interviewing him for the job and going so, quote unquote, outside the box. There's no doubt about it.
Or interviewing anyone else for that matter. It's not as though this isn't just about Keegan. This is the other players who are on that short list. If we can go down the list, it's Webb Simpson. It's, I think, Lucas Glover's name propped up on that list at some point. It's Stuart Sink. I mean, it was a pretty short list. After Tiger Woods said no, then they did have to pivot. And it was a shallow pool at that point. And that has a lot to do with sort of where the U.S. team and the Europeans are going to run into this as well, are because of Liv Goff. They have sort of ran out of captains that would have been in line, because you have to consider Phil Mickelson probably would have had at least, he definitely would have had one turn, maybe even two. Tiger will end up taking one turn, probably two. And so now all of a sudden you're looking, there's a decade taken up as it is. I understand where you're coming from. And I actually agree to a certain point that, yes, this is sort of an upside gamble on the PGA of America side, because you have a player who, I don't want to say is in his prime, but he clearly is a contemporary of all of these players on the team. He clearly is probably going to try to play his way onto that team. That's where the motivation stands right now. I think they would love to have sort of the conversation that could he be a playing captain, simply because it opens the doors to a lot of other things. And I think that's where John Wood, our colleague at NBC Sports and Golf Channel, comes in. In May, he was named the team manager of the U.S. team. The idea there being that he can take a lot of things off the captain's plate that he normally has to deal with. And I understand where this motivation is coming from, that you have someone now that understands exactly what it takes to get ready for a big tournament. And Keegan sort of laid this all out during his press conference. He knows exactly what top players do to get ready to play their best. So he's going to be able to pave that way probably better than someone who's not part of this generation, who hasn't been through everything that it takes now to compete at your prime. It is still such a gamble in my mind, because what you've essentially done, and this goes back to last year's Ryder Cup selection, you're right, that you've taken a guy that probably didn't get a selection because he's not quote-unquote part of the Cool Kids Club. He lives in South Florida, but he's not part of that South Florida Cool Kids Club. And now, essentially, you've put him in charge of the Cool Kids. I could see that going badly.
I could also see that being a big benefit. The fact that he's not necessarily playing favorites, has not necessarily have any earlier biases that he's fighting against. I really do think, and if you watch the press conference with Keegan Bradley on Tuesday, along with PGA of America President John Linder, I think you came away very impressed with Keegan. I really do believe that he could be an amazing captain. He's clearly a very sharp guy. He's very thoughtful. He's proven to be a great problem solver in his career, as evidenced by sort of his resurrection after the anchor ban. A lot of people thought that his career was left for dead. He ended up being, and is currently, a top 20 player in the world. I love the fact he's going to say he's going to talk to all of the winning and losing U.S. captains over the past 25 years to pick their brain on what could and couldn't work. Rex, what do you think will be Keegan's biggest challenge ahead as he looks not just to formulating the team, but also getting sort of the environment right for more American success?
I think it's the challenge, and the part that I probably liked the most out of this press conference yesterday, was he didn't get caught up in the politics of the moment at all. Number one, he was asked specifically about Phil being a potential vice captain, and he kind of dismissed that idea. But I loved the idea that he immediately leaned into Phil will be a captain one day, where maybe he sees the time in the future that is going to be appropriate, that somehow everything gets brought back together and Phil does get that turn as a captain. I think we would all love to see that. He also made it perfectly clear, I don't care what tour they play, I want the 12 best players. And you're right, to a certain degree, not being part of the Cool Kids Club could help out on this front, because he's going to be inclined not to go back to the old staples just because they've been old staples. He's going to go to who he thinks is best. We could end up with a very much a new look Ryder Cup team. So I think all of those things are going to work to your advantage. The drawback here is the expectations. And I think he's going to hear everything, all of these conversations for the next year and a half going into the Ryder Cup. And I think the pressure that's going to be on him not to have one slip up. He's going to try his best not to make one simple mistake. The simplest mistakes, pin cut on the wrong side of the green, something wrong with the setup, something wrong with the workout room, whatever it might be, he's going to have to avoid those issues.
So I think one of the biggest assets for Keegan is obviously his youth and to an extent his inexperience. But I also think that's a potential challenge that he could face. Like I like the idea of Team USA getting younger and setting up for the future. He said he's going to sort of put some vice captains in place who are younger and more a part of this generation. That's obviously a sharp rebuke of what has been pretty unimaginative retreads and the vice captains who have largely felt like lifetime achievement awards at the end of their decorated career. Seth Waugh called it a echo chamber of sameness that we've experienced in the Ryder Cup over the past decade. And like you look at it, Zach Johnson, his vice captains in Rome were Davis Love, Fred Couples, Stuart Sink, Jim Furyk, and Steve Stricker, with Tiger Woods very much involved from home. And so I love the idea of a Ryder Cup captain who looks and sounds and mirrors what the sport looks like at large. Like you look at the NFL, it's gotten younger and younger with head coaches under the age of 45 who don't necessarily have head coaching experience prior to that. You look at the NBA with coaches like Steve Kerr and Jason Kidd, who have sort of skipped that step of being an assistant coach as well. Like I do like that aspect of Team USA going that direction with the Ryder Cup as well. However, there is a balance to strike here, sort of owing to that experience gap. He needs to fill in his vice captaincies very efficiently and effectively here. That's where I think you can bring in a Fred Couples, a Steve Stricker, a Davis Love III. He said he's going to use Tiger as much as Tiger is willing to. And then you can also spin it ahead, where I would imagine like a Ricky Fowler would be a lock to be an assistant captain for this team, just because he's able to bridge that generational divide as well and being able to get younger. I think it's absolutely imperative that Keegan Bradley, because of his inexperience in this position, surrounds himself with the right captain's picks, because then that'll allow him to make the right calls with the captain's picks. It'll allow him to make the right calls with the pairings. It'll allow him to create an environment that allows the best players in the world to shine, which has not always been the case, particularly on the road for the Ryder Cup. Rex, you are in Scotland. Obviously, let's transition to the other big story of the week. I think you just froze up there, but we are perfectly okay. You just got done interviewing Rory McIlroy. It's the first time we've heard from Rory since the U.S. Open collapsed, particularly over the final hour. And anyone, Rex, who I think was upset, the fact that Rory did not speak to the media that Sunday at Pinehurst, like, this to me was the prime example of why you want to hear from Rory McIlroy. He is such an a gifted explainer. In his press conference today, he added context to his missed par putts on the 70th and 72nd hole. He fiercely defended caddy Harry Diamond and slammed in the process Hank Haney. He explained how he felt in the back nine that got him sort of out of his own world, which was a sort of a unique experience for him in a major championship. And he even said, somewhat depressingly, that he spent the first few days after the U.S. Open wandering around Manhattan, making calls and sitting with his thoughts. You interviewed him. What stood out?
Well, first, and you and I have gone back and forth since Pinehurst over this, and I do not feel like the players have to stop. There is no written guarantee that they have to stop and speak with the media, at least not in golf. Did I want Rory to stop? Yes, absolutely I did, because I was writing the Rory column that night. He was asked today, point blank, do you regret not stopping? His answer was very unequivocal. He came back with a absolutely not. Like, I was not in a position to answer your questions at that point. He understood where we were coming from. However, he said, you were the last thing on my mind, the media being the last thing on my mind as I was leaving the golf course on that Sunday night. I'll also point out that the answers we got today, while you're 100% correct, they were all thoughtful. It was exactly what we expected. I think you and I talked about this on Sunday on the podcast about what do you want to ask him? Well, I want to ask about Pinehurst because we haven't heard any answers. And now he's had 3 weeks to think about it. Yes, it was all well thought out. He had processed it. He had processed what happened that just not that Sunday at Pinehurst, but the entire week, how he was feeling that entire week. He processed what this means to his career and how he could learn from this. And I think we weren't going to get those answers on Sunday. He didn't have 3 weeks on Sunday. He had about 3 minutes to get in the car and drive away. So where I tend to agree, I would have liked to have heard what he said regardless. We weren't going to get those answers on Sunday at Pinehurst.
That's certainly fair. Like, obviously, he has the time and the context and able to contextualize it in the course of his career. I think a lot of people also, Rex, not just the fact that he didn't talk, I think a lot of people were butthurt that he didn't stick around to congratulate Bryson DeChambeau, with whom he was clearly locked in a head-to-head battle. A lot of people thought he should have stood around to shake his hand before he headed off on his way. Instead, he posted on Instagram the very next day, congratulating him. I loved the explanation, and I thought it was very interesting because being on the ground on that back nine, like, Rory was very aware of what Bryson DeChambeau was doing because everyone was aware of what Bryson DeChambeau was doing. There's an intimate sort of routing on the back nine of Pinehurst number two where greens are close to tees, tees are close to greens, fairways are sort of running adjacent to each other. Like, you knew exactly what was happening, and Rory said that he got out of his own little world. There's been a lot of talk about the club choice on 15, opting for a 7-iron that went over the back when he could have hit 8-iron into the middle of the green. There's been a lot of criticism of Harry Diamond for not sticking up there for the club choice, which obviously Rory shot down pretty forcefully. He also said, as we probably could surmise, the putt that lingers with him is not necessarily the one that he missed on 18. That was an excruciatingly difficult putt where he said he was playing it two and a half cups left on what was a 3.5-4 footer that if he missed in with a little bit too much speed, could have gone 10 feet past. Obviously, it was the 2-foot putt on 16 that he rimmed out. He said he caught himself looking to where Bryson was in the fairway, thinking ahead. He said Patrick Cantlay maybe slow played him a little bit on the green as well. That is the one that's kind of sticks in his craw a little bit more than the miss in the 72nd hole. It's been replayed so many times.
No, you've got the timing on that. Yes, he talked about the putt on 16, the 2.5 footer. He said that's when he quote unquote started to feel uncomfortable because he thought for a moment the birdie putt was going to drop, and then it was about an extra foot of rollout, and he realized he's put himself in a position that he didn't particularly want to be in. What he was referencing when you talked about where Bryson was, that's on the 18th hole. He knew as he stood over that par putt on the 18th green exactly where Bryson was back in the fairway. He saw that he was down the left-hand side in a difficult lie. And so it was situational at that point. He pointed out that if it was a match, he goes, I would have hit the putt much different. I would have been firm and not really cared about what I left myself. He said in this particular case, he knew Bryson was in trouble. He didn't know if he was going to make a bogey. He didn't know if he was going to make a par. So he didn't want to put himself in a position where he tries to make that putt and leaves himself 5-6 feet coming back. So that's sort of how the timing of that worked out. I guess the part that got me as he unpacked this is missed opportunity 100%, probably his best opportunity to win a major since he last won a major back in 2014. He understands all of those things. I am taken by the idea that he was able to sort of compartmentalize the entire week in its entirety, just not Sunday, just not the last four or five holes, the entire week and how he felt and how he starts to understand how he reacts, his body reacts. Certainly the 16th hole is an example of that, but how his mind reacted. And I'm not saying this is going to serve him well in the past, but he was really, really quick to point out that after these heartbreaking losses in the past, he has had a tendency of bouncing back. Certainly, you look at what happened at the Masters, made the turn and imploded, and just a few weeks later, he won another major championship. So I'm not saying that's going to happen, but he did do a really good job, I think, of today explaining exactly where his mind was.
Yeah, I think this would have been much different if that Pinehurst Open was the last major championship of the year, if all of a sudden he had 8 months to sit on it, now heading into an Open in the next week, like he can clearly sort of put that behind him, realize that the Pinehurst Open was one of the best ball striking majors of his entire career. What he was doing on that Sunday was something he had longed for, that had been missing over these past couple years. He was in line to shoot 65 or 66 on that Sunday before he came undone over that final hour. Like, that sort of golf is what we've been waiting for Rory McIlroy to do. And the fact that he did it for 68 holes, I think, is something that you can take positively. Now he looks ahead to the Open Championship, the last major championship that he won back in 2014. His record has been sterling in this event. In the past 8 Opens, 6 top 6 finishes. It's the style of golf that he obviously feels eminently comfortable in playing. And you have to figure that he's going to be in the mix again. I was taken aback, Rex, by the fact that we argued about this on Sunday at Pinehurst, whether this was the most devastating loss of Rory McIlroy's career. I said yes, clearly. You said no, definitively. Rory today said that the Augusta collapse in 2011, in which he went from up 4 to losing by 10 after a Sunday 80, as well as the 2022 Open Championship at St. Andrews, where he tied for the 54-hole lead, got lapped with a final round 70 in which he did not birdie any hole. That was not a 2-putt birdie on a par 5. Those two were harder to get over than Pinehurst. I found that very surprising.
And he put that in context as well, to the point you're trying to make, talking about, yes, those probably hurt more because of where he was in his career. Those hurt because he hadn't felt like he is at a point in his career where he's gotten to the point where he's fond of looking back and seeing the things he's accomplished. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, good for him. You know, enjoy your flowers while you can. But in this particular case, I think, yes, it hurt. Probably those 3 days wandering around New York City when apparently no one recognized him, which I find that hard to believe as well. But those 3 days, he was able to sort of think this through and put it in the context of, oh, I've done a lot in my career. This isn't going to be the end of me. I'll still have chances going forward. I think that's what he was trying to make. That's the point he was trying to make.
Rex, a busy week in golf, Evian Championship. There's a senior major. There's an opposite field event on the PGA Tour. And of course, there's the Scottish Open. Give the people something to look forward to this week at the tournament in which you are covering.
Well, I'm at the Scottish Open, and I think if you look at last year's finish, that should be reason enough. Rory won here last year. He put probably one of the best shots of the year on the 18th hole on Sunday. It was a 2-iron into the wind, just a gale of a breeze from 202 yards, hits it to 10 feet and makes the putt and to beat Robert McIntyre, who, of course, is trying to win his own Scottish Open. So there was a lot of emotions involved. This place has a history, has a tendency of producing kind of finishes like that. So I'm not saying don't watch the other ones, but definitely pay attention to what's happening in Scotland.
You have a tee time this afternoon after your Monday tee time at North
Barrett. I have. Let's do the tee time correction. Thank you.
At Mirrorfield on Wednesday. What are your expectations for your own game real quick?
TikTok. Actually played halfway decent on Monday at North Berwick. I will also say that I ran into a lot of players
playing North Berwick on Monday. If you've never played, I would make it a bucket list item for anyone who loves golf and can be a little geeky about it. You'll attest to that one. I was playing with super producer Andrew Bradley on Monday, and we played the first 12 holes. And I said, those 12 holes are really cool. They're really enjoyable. The next six, I could play every day for the rest of my life. They're quirky. They're fun. They're unique. They have character to them, like everything that makes it great. And I had the longest conversation that I've ever had in my life with a tour player about this, because Mark Hubbard and Ben Griffin were playing a match essentially right in front of us. It was them and their caddies playing a match against each other. And neither have ever been over to play Lynx Golf before. And my take was, your first experience to Lynx Golf is North Berwick. Like, that's about as good as it gets. And it's such a special place. It was a perfect afternoon. The sun was shining. It was warm. Bunkmate was waiting for me on the 18th green when I finished up. So it was pretty cool.
And folks, that will do it for this edition of Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lab. As you can tell, Rex has to go get in his 104 bad strokes at one of the world's great courses. We'll be back on Sunday afternoon following the conclusion of the Scottish Open. I will likely be in the Delta Sky Club making my own way over to Scotland for next week's Open Championship. In the meantime, you guys know the drill. EmbassySports.com/golf. For our latest news, notes, and updates. Have a great rest of your week. We'll talk to you guys on Sunday.